Oh, yeah.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Friday, April 3rd. We have four work sessions and a public hearing, so we'll get started with a work session on House Bill 2011. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2011 expands allowable purposes for establishment of individual development accounts as specified, allows money in accounts to be rolled over into college savings network accounts or individual retirement accounts when conditions of personal development plans are met, extends the sunset of tax credits for both withdrawals from individual development accounts and donations to fiduciary organizations for distribution to individual development accounts. The revenue impact came back further analysis required, and we are adding a subsequent referral to the Committee on joint Tax Credits.
Thank you, Victoria. I'm surprised it wasn't there by prior reference, but it obviously needs to go to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, given that it not only extends but expands and alters the Individual Development Account program. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move that House Bill 2011 go to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2011 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Is there a discussion on the motion, Representative Wisnick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I think this is such a good bill. I requested the chair let me be a co-sponsor, which he did, and I'm co-sponsor. I think it's a great bill.
Thank you. I would say I really appreciate the work that the coalition has done to carefully consider how the program should be modernized, updated, extended, and expanded. And I will, as a member of the Joint Tax Credit Committee, certainly be trying to carry the message of this committee there. Other discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2011 is on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Close the work session on House Bill 2011. And open the work session on House Bill 2561. Representative Greenlick, your timing is perfect. Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2561 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to evaluate the best method of overseeing public universities to ensure that at least one minority applicant is interviewed when hiring head coach or athletic director, requires the HEC to report results of evaluation during 2016 regular session of the legislature. We have data amendments that we are looking at, and it came back with no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. And Representative Greenlick, would you like to talk about your amendment, or I'm sorry, I didn't. Okay. Well, let's see if that's necessary from the rest of the committee. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 3/2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves the dash two amendments dated March 20, 2015. Any discussion? Any objections?
No discussion.
Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm going to vote for the bill. I think I'm not sure we need it. I think we needed the other bill to have a little more chance to work, but it's I don't think it's a big requirement on the universities, and we can get positive results. That's much that much better. So I will be a yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Wisnick. Other discussion?
I apologize for being late.
No problem.
Which bill are we working on?
We're on 2561, the so-called Rooney Rule. We have dash two amendments that Victoria described. So the motion right now is on those amendments.
Thank you.
No problem. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move that House Bill 2561 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2561 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I kind of go back and forth on this bill. On the one hand, I was moved by the witness who said we're not looking for a carve out. All we're looking for is a chance, and if we get a chance, we know we have the skills and we can make it. On the other hand, there's a part of me that says that it's 2015 and these kinds of special circumstances and rules like that are based on race or whatever we need to maybe rethink doing some of those, and maybe it's a little late in the game, no pun intended, to do that kind of stuff. So I'm also concerned about some of the kind of unintended consequences. We spoke about how this impacts women as minorities and things like that, and I think maybe the time has come to quit making a mess of things, and let's just have a clean playing field and give everybody a fair shot. So I expect to be a no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Nero. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern, I guess, is with giving this responsibility to the HEC. I guess I remain concerned about the propensity that sometimes we have for continuing to put more and more things on their plate, because they're kind of a convenient avenue to to give the
and they're so capable.
And they're so capable. They do a fine job. I don't believe that was the role of the HEC when we created it. You know, I'm not seeing outcomes and academic achievements here. But I'll go ahead and support the bill. But I just wanted to get on the record that I'm concerned about the propensity that I think this building sometimes have for just putting things on their work list, and then I think it takes their eye off the ball on some really needful work that they could be doing. So I've said that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Appreciate that. Other comments or discussion on the motion? Noting Representative Nierman's objection to the motion, are there other objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, noting again Representative Nierman's objection. And House Bill 2561 heads to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Greenlick, I assume you'd be willing to carry?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2561 and move to a work session on House Bill 2569. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2569 extends the sunset for tax credit for University Venture Development Fund contributions, provides that tax credit is to be claimed in one tax year, increases amount of total outstanding contributions and corresponding tax credit certificates allowed, requires universities with university development funds to achieve annual agreement for allocation of available contribution amount, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2016, takes effect on 91st day following adjournment signing die. We have -2 amendments proposed. They came back with a revenue impact of further analysis required. They are posted on OLIS, and the measure does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Thank you, Victoria. I was afraid I was going to have to interrupt you when you perhaps started to describe the amendments. Fortunately, Debbie Koreski is here from Portland State. We're going to ask her to help us understand the -2 amendments. They are significant as a result of, I think, a fair bit of work. Let's hear from her. Ms. Koreski.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Debbie Koreski from Portland State University. I'd like to thank Representative McEwen for wearing PSU green today. It's PSU green Friday. Every Friday you can see that I am not wearing PSU green.
Duly noted.
Right, so thank you. So the -2 amendments do represent a pretty significant change from where we started from the bill. This we've worked collectively between the Oregon's four research universities and the four true universities, and then we've also worked significantly with Legislative Revenue and then the Department of Revenue to craft the amendment, as well as the sponsor of the bill, Representative Williamson, and several other members of the legislature who were around for the original crafting of this bill many years ago. The first change in the amendment, in the -2 amendment, is that it extends the tax credit for 8 years. The legislature currently has a process where you review tax credits every 6 years. We're asking for an 8-year extension because we're kind of the tax credits are grouped into buckets, and the tax credits are similar. And because of when this tax credit was created, we're in a bucket where we're the odd duck in that bucket. So, sorry.
Duck? No, I know.
Yeah, I know.
Be careful.
Be careful. We don't fit. We're with the working families credit and other things like that. And we're asking to be put into the business bucket, which is up for review in another 2 years, which we don't think is a long enough time. And then we'll be up again in another 8 years. So that's the first change. The second change is right now the State Board of Higher Education takes this credit. If you remember the gentleman that was here from Portland State University that does the sensors on the water...
Sweet sensors.
Sweet sense. Right. Yeah. This is mm-hmm. this hearing. I'm take you back in time a little bit. But this tax credit is actually structured more like a revolving loan fund. There's currently a bucket of $15 million that the state provides. Private donors... give to that fund, and then they can receive a 60% tax credit on that fund. And but we, the universities, pay that fund back with revenues that we generate from patents or intellectual property, equity that we hold in firms. So it's really, I always like to think about it more like a revolving loan type of situation. It's the only tax credit structure that way. Right now, the state extends to us $15 million worth of credit. Since the creation of the fund, we're starting to butt up against that $15 million. And we anticipate that some of the new efforts from OHSU involving the Knight Cancer may take us beyond that. So we're asking to extend the credit limit slightly. It takes the universities about 8 to 10 years to start paying back once we give someone a donation. We anticipate that timeline to be 8 to 12 years. So we've started paying back into the fund, but we probably need an additional maybe 4 or 5 years before you see really significant repayments. So we're asking for
that.
So
I want to jump in there with two questions. You mentioned it extends the cap slightly to what?
Oh, $25 million. It's not slightly. It's $25 million.
Okay.
And we've worked with legislative revenue to kind of set these changes, and then we anticipate when we get into the Joint Tax Credit Committee that we'll work with that committee. If the revenue impact is too large, we'll start revising things down to make sure that we can fit into whatever the budget is within the Joint Tax Committee should they decide that we're a tax credit that should move forward for reauthorization.
And just to be clear, for my own benefit and perhaps others, when you said when we make a donation, that means a contribution or an investment in a university. University-inspired business, is that correct?
Well, you give the money to the university, and then the university makes the decision about how to invest that money.
Right. And that's that second part that I wanted to be clear on. When you said when we make a donation, that means when the university is investing that in a business or a research or that sort of thing.
A private investor would say to the university may have a donor and say, hey, it's usually honestly an add-on at a lot of the universities. You have a donor that wants to make a contribution to the university, and the way we've seen it work best is we say, you know, there's this tax credit if you're interested in investing in commercialization of research from universities. If you're willing to give an extra $100,000, you can get a 60% tax credit on your donation. And we've had a lot of people take us up on that offer. We've seen donations stay pretty small up to this point. It's usually someone who's making a larger donation and they tack on maybe an additional $100,000, $250,000. But I think the largest gift so far has been just shy of $400,000.
And so the contribution goes to the university. And the university decides where that goes into which sort of research and commercialization.
And that is correct.
That's the piece I want to get. Thank you.
That is correct. The donor is not able to designate a specific company or a specific research effort to donate to.
Right.
I think the third major change is that within that pot, currently the State Board of Education, the State Board of Higher Education divides up how much each university gets to spend out of that. And with the dissolution of that, the universities are proposing that we can do that through a mutual agreement between all of us, and that allows us some flexibility to slide that. OSU is quickly approaching their cap, and so the other universities still have a lot of elasticity within their cap, so it would make sense that the other universities would say, here, we don't think we're going to use ours. You can borrow from us for a while, and as we start repaying back, we'll manage that, and then we'll report to the HEC every year about what the status of the fund is, and the HEC will send that report into the legislature so that we can still have some transparency and some accountability in how that proceeds forward. I think the biggest change, the most significant change, is right now the University Venture Development Fund, the way the tax credit is administered at the Department of Revenue because of how the statute is written is different than how other tax expenditures and tax credits are administered. We are the only one. Donors can only take a $50,000 maximum credit, and they can take that over a span of years. Most tax credits say the maximum tax credit that you may take is X, maybe $100,000, but you can have that as a 3-year carry forward. So you can take it all in the first year, all in the second year, you can split it out 25-25, you know, 50 if that's how you want to do it. That's the standard way that the department administers tax credits, and ours is different, and so we are aligning the UVDF to look like other tax credits. We set the maximum tax credit in this bill really high, and again, that's another thing that we anticipate that we'll work with the tax credit committee to revise down and to try to fit into whatever budget should that committee want to move our tax credit forward.
Great. Representative McHugh.
Chair Reed, thank you. Do you happen to know the history of why it was structured that way? Is there something different about it that precipitated that structure?
Yeah. This is Senator Morse was the champion of this bill, and people were pretty skeptical of this. They didn't know exactly how this would work, and I think it was they wanted to have the very tightest controls possible on the credit to try it out first. And I think that they thought that it could turn into kind of a free-for-all. And I think, you know, now that we have a good 10 years of history underneath our belt, people can see of how it would work, and I think it would make more sense to align it with the other tax expenditures.
So the program's matured is what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue. Representative Wisnett, sorry.
Thank you. Policy, great. I approve. I think I'm policy. What assurance will revenue, I'm assuming the chair is on the revenue committee, but we've had some bad experiences with Betsy and things in the past. Is there some watchdogs or some people looking at so we don't overcommit to the $25 million a couple of times or something?
So the maximum credit limit, whatever the tax credit committee would set, would be the most the universities could. It would cut off. The department would cease to issue credits if we were to ever bump up against our credit limit. So you know, the credit limit is the credit limit. I think what the other important control that's contained in the Dash 2 amendment is what is the total maximum amount of the credit. When we met with legislative revenue initially, we thought, you know, probably the total amount of the tax credit should be $600,000, because that would be $1 million donation. And this, again, as I mentioned, our history with the current system is that people give to this in sort of smaller amounts. And so the Dash 2 amendment actually, the way that it's currently crafted, says the maximum amount of the credit is $1 million. And with all frankness, I don't think that we will proceed out of the tax credit committee at that high of a limit. But it shows you, even at that significant expansion of the credit, that you don't have a significant revenue impact according to the initial analysis by LRO. It's still a fairly modest revenue impact to the state, even at that huge expansion of the credit, which I think will be much more narrow by the time we move out of joint tax credit committee, should we do that.
So you may not have seen it behind you, but another expert on tax credits has entered the room, Chris Alanek.
Okay.
Representative Wisnett, do you want to ask that question of the legislative revenue office?
I think it's good on the record, and I'll trust you, Chair, to be sure that gets passed in revenue.
I think we're in good shape there. It is, as we talked about, headed to the joint committee on tax credits as well. I didn't mean to cut you off. Are you
If you remember from the testimony, it's been a very effective tax credit.
Yep.
And we have started repaying into the loan. So it's a lengthy process. So far been very effective in spurring that private investment that we were looking for in the original purpose of the creation of the fund. So thank you.
Good. Chris, do you have anything to say? I'm sure capably to answer questions, but we also want to give you the chance to talk if you'd like to.
I just shut up for questions.
Okay. Any questions for Legislative Revenue? Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Debbie. You've talked a lot about the credit part. Could you elaborate a little bit on the repayment part and where we are on that? It sounds like it's been a 10-year program. And
If you remember when the panel came before, they showed you a nice timeline chart that showed how research moves through the commercialization pipeline. And underneath that chart, it said 8 to 12 years. That's sort of the standard of how long it takes someone from a federally funded grant to move into some sort of commercialized product and maybe into the market. It's a pretty lengthy time period. So we are still in the very beginnings of that. And to date, I could get you the exact number, but in the ballpark, we've repaid about $500,000 into the fund, and I'm going to look at Chris. Yay, good.
I'm sorry. Half a million out of a total of, what was it?
How many total of the credits that would have been issued to date? Now we're going to need Chris. So I don't have those numbers in front of me.
Chris has them in his head. I'm not right.
He's brilliant, so yes, I bet he does.
Mr. Chair, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And I don't have the exact number off my head, but it's a few million dollars of tax credits that have been issued.
Okay, and we're half. So the program is working as projected, or?
I think so, and I missed some of the testimony, but there is a timeline issue. Initially, I think the projection was 8 to 12 years before money would start coming back. Yeah. So the fact that we have $500,000 starting to come back, it's on track, I think, roughly with expectations. Some of these investments can take quite a while before they come to fruition.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure it's working as planned. So good. Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions? Comments? Okay, we're in work session. Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated March 18, 2015.
They're escaping. Representative Gallegos has moved the -2 amendments dated March 18, 2015. Any discussion of the motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. The -2 amendments are adopted. Representative Gallegos.
Chair Reed, I move House Bill 2569 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved House Bill 2569 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And House Bill 2569 is headed to the Revenue Committee before the Joint Tax Credit Committee. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2569 and open the work session on House Bill 2973.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2973 establishes the Affordable Baccalaureate Degree Act, requires public universities to offer two or more bachelor's degrees at cost of $10,000 or less, beginning with 2019-2020 academic year, establishes degree requirements, declares emergency as effective on passage. We have proposed -2 amendments that direct the public universities to work toward providing four-year affordable fixed-cost baccalaureate degrees, requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to analyze available options for affordable degrees and report findings to the 2016 Legislative Assembly. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett, this is your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And honorable committee colleagues, after we heard the affordable bachelor's degree bill, House Bill 2973, Chair Reed gave me the go-ahead to see if we could come up with a bill which all could support and pass, I guess is the word, seeking an affordable bachelor's degree. I worked with the very competent Dana Richardson from the HEC. Representative Mark Johnson had some things that he had put in his bill. We put in here with his staff, Cassie Haight. And Dana did get input from the – we had a -1. We sent that out, got other changes. And then what you're asking to approve today is the -2. As you see, it's a completely new bill. It eliminates the reference to $10,000. We're saying the most says now public universities shall work towards developing and providing four-year baccalaureate degrees or pathways to baccalaureate degrees that are affordable and offered at a fixed cost that is significantly less than the cost of a traditional baccalaureate degree at the universities. We also had great following on this bill by OSAC, who is interested in it, obviously. The bill requires the HEC to submit a report describing the analysis conducted to the Legislative Committee on Higher Education during the 2016 regular session of the Legislative Assembly. And that should be us, and then we'll get a chance to see. My hope, colleagues, is that this that the university's presence, as I testified before, they seemed enthusiastic about trying to do this and come up with a degree. The bill without the specific amount now enables them to do more. But I'm hoping that in 2016 we can hear that they're ready to offer an affordable bachelor's degree, which would help students beginning in the fall of 2017. I urge you to vote to pass the bill to create an affordable college degree. I think this committee can take pride if we pass this bill and we help students with textbooks. We can really be proud of helping bring down the cost of education and increasing access for many. And I'd like to have the committee members, as many as won't, sign up for the bill before it goes to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Other comments? Representative Nierman, then Representative Johnson.
Is this on the amendment?
Yes, we have, which the amendments have not yet been moved nor adopted, but I wanted to give Representative Wisdom a chance to talk, so I expect we'll have a motion on that in a moment.
So I'll wait to comment on the amendment.
Okay, very good. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've enjoyed working with the Honorable Representative on this concept. My office and I did a lot of work on this last February, and a lot of those components that we had in our bill are in this bill now, too. So I think it's a great concept. It's innovative. I think it's the kind of thing we ought to be thinking about as a state. How can we provide affordable pathways that are directly related to careers? And that's what I would hope would come out of this. But, you know, sometimes just like, you know, a fine wine needs a little aging. I think this concept has aged, and it's ready to pop the cork this session. So,
And it's in the wine cellar at the Heck, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Ben Cannon has assured me he'd take good care of it.
Good. Very good. Other comments? Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I really support the bill, like the concept. I do understand putting a dollar figure into a statute is difficult to do, but do we have a feel for what significantly less means now in comparison to a traditional bill into a traditional bachelor degree? And do we have an average of what the traditional bachelor degree is to kind of base that off of?
Representative Wisdom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hayden. As I told you in my original testimony, that there are colleges that have come up with $10,000 degrees. And also, as I tell you, one of the university presidents came in my office and said he was working on the 10,000. So, you know, I don't think it's impossible. I think that from what I remember, and if someone else can correct me, I think we're looking at an average cost of education for tuition and fee now is probably under 20,000 at state universities for in-state students. Of course, the big cost is textbooks, as we're going to work on that, and also housing and food and stuff like that. So I think it's under 20,000. So I hope that I'm hoping that we can come in under 15,000 or something. And still, anything less is better. And, yeah. And again, I'd be sure that the committee understands, is it the third paragraph says that these degrees have to meet university standards. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's important.
Yeah. So, I did. Representative Hayden?
Thank you. Follow up. I was just, I don't know if it would be appropriate, but looking for like 60% of a goal of 60% of the average of the traditional degree or something. So significant was defined a little more just so we don't get, I mean, 10% significant. Yeah. Significant is,
right.
Anyway, but I like the bill.
Representative Hayden, I appreciate that comment. And part of my concern initially with the initial version of 10,000 is that there's nothing, at least for me, magic about a fixed number in either direction. So if 10,000, we shouldn't stop at 10,000. If there's a way to meet the standards and go further below that, sure. That would be good too. So I like the approach in this bill of significant, though I take your point about that being a relatively vague term.
It says reductions, so that's
yes.
Down.
Okay. Yes, okay. That's right. The comments, Representative Williamson, and then Representative Jaggers.
I want to thank Representative Wisnant for all the work he did on this. I think this is a good balance between affordability and quality.
Yes.
Because one of my concerns about having a fixed number or a fixed percentage is it depends on the degree and it depends on what's necessary to get that degree. And what we don't want to do is set up a program where there's a substandard degree that is not of the quality that we would expect out of our public universities. And so I think building in this flexibility allows for you to say an engineering degree that is substantially less, maybe 80%, but a political science degree like my own, you might be able to cut it in half. I don't know. So it just it depends on what's necessary for that degree, and I don't want to give up any quality.
Thank you, Representative Williamson. I agree with that heartily. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to comment that I assume people saw the article in the paper the other day that Stanford actually is giving free tuition to students with families who make less than $120,000. So I think this is a step in that direction, maybe.
Thank you, Representative Gagas. Representative McKeown?
Chair Reed, thank you. I just pulled up the cost of attendance at the University of Oregon that is projected for the 15, 16, For the 15-16 school year for the University of Oregon, for an in-state tuition, the estimated cost of attendance is $25,167 if you multiply that by four.
And that includes living expenses,
it
correct?
Does. Okay. It does. And if you just look at tuition, it's $10,287 for an in-state resident and $32,000 for a non-resident.
That's over 4 years as well?
No.
That's 1 year. So. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Representative Gallegos?
Oh, yeah. Chair Reed, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 27, 2015.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves the Dash 2 amendments dated March 27, 2015. We're now in discussion on the amendments. Representative Nierman, thanks for waiting.
I'm just going to get in behind Representative Hayden and, in part, Representative Williamson. I was just putting a non-indexed dollar amount in the statute kind of makes me nervous.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that this doesn't do that, and I just want to get that on the record. So.
Very good. Thank you. Other comments on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. The Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Representative Gallegos?
Chair Reed, I move that House Bill 2973 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved House Bill 2973 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2973 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who should we have carry this bill?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Representative Wisden, I assume you'll carry the bill.
I'd be pleased to on behalf of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Wisden will carry. Close the work session on House Bill 2973 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3049. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3049 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop a plan for public universities to have a ratio of at least 7-1 of public employees to supervisory employees. Requires the HEC to report on status of plan to Joint Committee on Ways and Means each odd-numbered year. Regular sessions. Becomes operative January 1, 2016. Declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you, Victoria. Representative Gorsuch, Senator Dembrough, thanks for your patience. Glad to hear from you.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see. It's kind of like old home. We care, Representative Wisnett Johnson. It's nice to see you all. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Gorsuch. I am the House Representative for District 49, East Multnomah County. I am here today to testify in support of HB 3049. House Bill 3049 is legislation that addresses some of the concerns many of us had after reviewing the report that was the result of House Bill 2152. The history and background of that particular bill will be covered here in just a moment by my colleague, Senator Dembrough. I'd like to speak for a moment about the excess of management positions as it relates to frontline classified employees. So just to make it clear, we're not talking now about student-teacher ratios. We're not talking about anything other than the support staff in these universities. Having an average of 2.9 workers per supervisor really gets at an area where I think there's opportunity to find efficiencies. We have situations in higher ed where supervisors are watching over perhaps one or two people, even supervisors that are supervising no one. You see these things and it makes you wonder and causes many of us to question why the decision was made to do this and if the position is appropriately designated as a supervisory position. This is a concern on a number of levels for those of us who are involved in higher education as we consider and vote on budgets that, because of a host of revenue and fiscal concerns, we're asking all of our institutions to work towards greater efficiency. Finding efficiency is important for workers and students. I've seen where people are frustrated by these substantial layers of supervisors, whether it's dealing with it as an undergrad or it's dealing with it as an employee working in that environment. As costs and tuition continue to rise at a rate completely out of proportion to other consumer spending, these, I think, are very important considerations. It's all about, in the end, the bottom line. Taxpayers are looking for us to ensure that we are good stewards of their money. Working to have good staffing ratios, I believe, is one way of doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Let's hear from Senator Dembrough first.
Hey, I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the state senator for District 23. That's northeast and southeast Portland. Ms. Chair, colleagues, it's a pleasure to be here this morning to serve once again as your resident historian, to turn back the clock a bit, to let you know how we got to this point. Before I do that, though, I do want to say I'm really pleased to hear that you've passed this House Bill 2973 as amended. I look forward to signing on to it when it gets over to the Senate side. It's, as Rep. Johnson mentioned, this is something we've been looking at for a while, and I think you've really found a good form for it, something that really stresses the notion of pathways, making those pathways as easy as possible for people, and as a result of that, I think bringing down the cost of attendance. Mm-hmm. And that question of the cost of attendance really is kind of related to this bill as well, I think, because we often hear concern about the rising cost of college, and one of the assertions that's out there is that college is becoming more expensive because institutions are investing more and more in climbing walls and fancy dorms, and also in adding more administration to their staffs. And in order to sort of test that latter assumption, back in 2013, we passed House Bill 2152, which charged the HEC with collecting annual reports from the institutions on the numbers of employees in the different categories, the different employee categories, faculty, full-time and part-time, classified staff, non-teaching professionals, supervisors, and managers. And the goal there was to, to get a handle on, just what our administrator or supervisor to frontline staff ratios were and to track them over time. Because, we want to make sure that the dollars that are being distributed by the HEC are being used as much as possible to support instruction and student support directly. So so that's sort of one strand that leads to this bill. Another is some work that we've been doing on state employees that started in 2011 and then 2012. I was very engaged in it in 2012 together with Representative Cameron and, I don't know, Rep. Wisnant, you may have been involved in that as well, where a target was set. Remember, we were in the midst of the recession. We were slashing positions in state government. And we wanted to make sure that we were doing that in a way that would keep the focus on frontline service, right, so that people were so that the services being given to customers and clients were being impacted as little as possible. We were getting the most bang for the buck. And at the same time, taking advantage of that to flatten the management structure as much as possible. And so a target was set of 11 staff to one supervisor. And we created an implementation timeline for that, where there were also some exceptions for, certain circumstances where it just didn't make sense, small regional offices, some other things like that. And that basic philosophy, I think, is what is behind this bill. At that time, in 2011, in 2012, the universities were still, quasi part of a quasi-state agency. Now they have their different boards, but the notion of it is still the same. How can we flatten out that administrative structure to make sure that students and their families are getting the biggest bang for the buck? where the target at the state employee level was 11 to 1. Here in this bill, I think it's 7 to 1.
Yeah, I think that's
right. So it's different. And I will say, just in my experience in academia, where on the instructional side of the house, you have a pretty lean administrative structure generally. You know, you'll have a dean, and that dean may have, you know, many, many faculty, and including, you know, part-time, full-time working under them. On the instructional side, there is more of a sense of sort of self-supervision or self-governance, if we could call it that. Where I think there is perceived to be more of a problem is on the college support, the university support side of the house. So that's what this bill is all about, and I'm not sure I know much more about it than that, but I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you, Senator Dembrough. Are there questions for either of our colleagues? Representative Reardon.
I just wanted to make sure I'm trying to read this and be attentive to your excellent presentation. Did you say this was primarily for classified or only for classified? Because I keep seeing faculty mentioned in here as I'm reading. So
it should only be for classified.
To be honest, I'm not sure how to. I'm not that closely, familiar with this bill. But
I think we have a number of other people who are going to testify.
That's
great.
I believe
reserve that question
Representative
too.
Reardon,
Mr. Chair, I believe it is focused on classified.
There should be someone coming behind us that can clarify.
And then just comment. Working in industry for over 20 years, I mean, I would have been really happy with 10 to 1.
So, I know.
7 to 1 seems like a very reasonable target, not being overly aggressive at all.
And if I may, Mr.
Please.
Chair, Senator Dembrough's is his experience talking about the instructional side is mine too. We even at the community college level, we find that we have deans that are over actually multiple departments, and they may be over 20 to 40 to 50 faculty. So. It really is a little different on that side of the fence.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if either one of you would know the answer to this, but I would be curious to know what the landscape looks like at both Eastern and Southern now that they have kind of gone through the retrenchment process there, and maybe how that might have impacted their ratios of supervisors to employees, because I know they've been dealing with that, obviously talking about faculty, courses, and so forth, but maybe we could get some input from them, because I'm guessing that they must have at least encountered the issue in their process. So the other question I would have is, it's specific to public universities. Do you have colleges in mind as well, the colleges, or are they left out intentionally? Or?
Before the answer, Representative Johnson, Representative Wisnett points out a handout that we have that does appear to have some information on some of those institutions. It may not be exactly what you want, but it may help. Please go ahead.
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't really have the answer to the first question, but I assume there'll be people here who can.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the reason that this is targeted at the universities is the universities were very recently within the world of state government, right? And mm-hmm. you know, the in terms of the classified staff, there's still a single professional union that represents them all at all the universities. So I think there's more of a sense that they can compare apples to apples there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gorsuch.
Representative Johnson, I would say, however, that there's certainly room to expand it to two-year institutions as well.
At some point, maybe.
Exactly. That's not what this bill does, but certainly there would be room for consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much, both. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
We have a number of other people to testify. You both mentioned the experience of the bill that we passed before, so we'd like to hear from Madeline Zeich from DAS, particularly about the experience that followed our passage of that other bill. Ms. Zeich, thanks for being here.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer at DAS, and in the executive branch. And thank you for asking me to come and meet with you today. This is the first time that I've been before this committee, Chair Reed, and so excited to be here, learning some really interesting things just sitting here watching.
We're glad you're here.
I just have a brief presentation for you this morning about our experience implementing the ratio. The representatives right before me actually stole some of my speech because they gave you a little bit of information about some of the legislation that was passed. In 2011, House Bill 2020 required DAS to develop a plan to adopt the 11-to-1 ratio for agencies with more than 100 FTE. In 2012, we had House Bill 4131 that required agencies to make progress towards the 11-to-1 ratio. And in 2013, House Bill 3165 clarified the exception criteria. With the new 11-to-1 staffing ratio, agencies are required to move toward the 11-to-1 ratio requirement. It was based on a similar requirement in Texas, as I understand this, but this all happened before I got here. And it impacts 28 agencies, again, with more than 100 FTE. It required agencies to either lay off or reclassify supervisory positions to increase the ratio, allowed the DAS director to consider mission-critical exception requests, and required reporting to the legislature as part of the development of the legislatively adopted budget. To implement the requirements, agencies worked with DAS and evaluated job duties of each supervisory versus non-supervisory position. Agencies began restructuring and realigning their supervisory ranks and doing some reorganizations within their agencies to meet the legislative goal between 2011 and 2012. 140 positions had supervisory duties removed, and 187 supervisory positions were slated for abolishment after this work was completed. Some of the factors that we have dealt with in the executive branch are that most of our supervisors are working supervisors in the executive branch. They often have other duties outside of just supervisory duties. And sometimes they are technical supervisors for other technicians. For example, we may have a supervising electrician. We're required to have one of those so that we can have electricians performing work. And that's one of the things that we've needed to deal with. We've also needed to work with the communication between employees and supervisors. Even though it's 11-to-1, it doesn't mean that every unit within an agency has 11-to-1. So in some agencies, you may have some units within the agency that have 20, another has 11, I think as was referenced earlier. So communication protocols needed to be developed and technology to support some of those. Here in Oregon, I'm learning our technology in many areas is not really robust. Mm-hmm. So that's been a
very diplomatic.
Another consideration and factor is the supervision of staff in geographically dispersed areas. So, for example, parks. We have the state parks with the millions of visitors that we have, many of them in remote areas. We needed to make sure that they had supervisory advice and guidance when needed without having a supervisor necessarily available to be in their location. And I don't want to have you come away thinking this was all negative. We did some really, I think, valuable work and continue to do valuable work around really refining supervisory duties, really looking at organizational structures, and what works best for managing the organization. Roles, recruitment and retention for supervisors. So being in HR, we're always looking forward to what we need to do to recruit and retain good supervisors. And we have about, I heard from PERS just recently, 30 to 35% of the overall state workforce that's eligible to retire in the next 5 years. Doesn't mean they're going to do it, but they're eligible if they choose to do so. So as we look at the role of supervisors and the span of control that they have and the amount of responsibilities they have, we need to make sure that we're able to find people that want to accept those jobs moving forward. And career progression opportunities really ties into that, making sure that employees feel like there's somewhere to go and move into supervisory ranks. And then the last implementation factor that I want to talk a little bit about was the mentoring staff and ensuring for accountability and performance appraisals and all of those things that you make sure that your employees are being developed and they're getting what they need and you're holding them accountable. There are some areas in which this has been a challenge with the number of direct reports. And those are some of the things that we're continuing to work with agencies on as we move toward fully implementing the ratio. So one of the professional organizations that we look at in the HR world is the Society of Human Resource Management. And that's really our overarching professional group that we look to for guidance on best practice and those sorts of things in the workforce. Some of the things, as I was doing the research, that they recommend that we look at when we're determining span of control is the organizational size of an agency. So larger agencies may have a little bit more flexibility to have a larger number of reports. Smaller agencies with more autonomy usually have a little bit more difficulty with that. And then also looking at the workforce skill level, the complexity of the work, are they routine tasks, are they tasks that really require a lot of individual attention and support? The organizational culture, organizations that have a more flexible workplace can often have fewer supervisors, those that have less rules, those that are just more flexible workplaces. We also like to look at managers' responsibilities. Are they also involved in strategic planning activities? Are they doing the training? What are the other things that they do outside of standard supervision? The physical proximity, I mentioned that. The technology, I'm always making the pitch for good technology in the HR world. And then training. Can lead workers, which we have done quite a bit of, be trained in basic supervisory skills, not the full breadth of supervision, but to pick up some of that, those supervisory duties when they're needed. And then we also need to be continually making sure that they're in appropriate classification. So as we're doing some of this lead work or semi-supervisory work, that we're complying with our bargaining units and our classifications as they were designed. And I think that was all I had prepared for you today, unless you have some questions for me.
I suspect we may very well have some questions for you. We have one other little piece of business we have to take care of before we proceed to that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative McEwen to vote on House Bill 2011.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett has asked for unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow Representative McEwen to vote on House Bill 2011. Is there any objection?
Thank you.
Seeing none, so ordered. Representative McEwen, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative McEwen votes aye. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett.
So back to questions, and a couple of us have to leave for Ways and Means Committee that is also happening at the same time. I would ask one just to start, which will probably just display my ignorance on this topic. You mentioned sort of semi-supervisory and lead worker and that sort of stuff. Can you give, maybe it's just me, a little more background on how that distinction is made and what are the elements of that kind of definition?
Representative Reed and members of the committee, I can give you a little bit of information about that. Lead workers are assigned to lead work, to not necessarily provide supervisory duties, that is hire, fire, promote, demote, prepare performance and evaluation, but lead the assignments of the day. So if a crew is going out and they have a number of things that they need to accomplish, somebody needs to be able to lead and project manage that work. A lead worker will often do that. They do get a differential on their pay when they're doing that. Some lead workers love doing that, and they that is one way of teaching people some supervisory skills. Others, it makes them a little uncomfortable because they're the lead worker today, and then they go back and they're the peer with their coworkers the next day. And so it's a matter of teaching them those kinds of skills around, you know, being a lead worker, but not being too directive because you realize you're going back into the work unit the next day.
Thank you. Are those definitions all easily agreed on? Do you get into situations where there's some disagreement about whether a given person is a lead worker or supervisor, or how does that work?
Representative Reed, I haven't heard too many of those discussions where there's any disagreement, okay, for instance, with labor or with the employees.
Okay, great. Representative Reed.
A couple of questions. Do you have positions that are, you'd consider them to be individual contributors where they maybe manage a function, and so they should be, they're kind of like supervising themselves? I'm thinking of somebody that works, and examples that I know of, work in a company that's, say, a government relations person. So they're managing their own day-to-day affairs, but they still report to somebody. But is there...
Yeah. Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, we do have those, and you're right on. We call them professional individual contributors, and those are people like legislative liaisons. sometimes a one- or two-person function within an organization. Project managers sometimes are considered individual contributors. Yes, we do have those.
This is maybe beyond what we should be asking you this morning, but I'd be really curious, do you... We've talked a lot about management and supervision. Do you have something that addresses leadership development? And by that, I mean people that will challenge the culture, who will be looking for what needs to be done, and who will really take, you know, leadership. And I think that's very different than managing a day-to-day function, which is kind of how do you maintain the status quo and get the reports written and all of that. So can you comment on that?
Yes. Chair Reed, Representative, I can, and I'm really glad you asked me that question because I'm very passionate about leadership development and developing the workforce. Each agency has some of that within their agencies, and some of our larger agencies have more of those types of opportunities for people to learn and grow, and we like to call them the emerging leaders. In the economic downturn, what was that? How long ago was that now? 4 or 5 years ago, there were some programs that that DAS had and other agencies had that could start to identify and mentor and groom emerging leaders, and unfortunately, those had to be cut. So we're working out of my office on a real workforce development plan that includes just the kinds of things that you're asking about, identifying those people that we can move into positions, strengthening skills that they already have and they haven't had a chance to exercise, and really developing a workforce that's very agile. And part of it is out of necessity for succession planning, as I mentioned, with so many people that could leave the state workforce at any time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And thanks for the presentation, Ms. Zeich. There's a concept that I've heard of. I'm not an HR person, and it's called the quit rate. And it refers to the fact that you can expect that a certain number of employees will leave their jobs over time. And it's my understanding that the quit rate in state government is quite different than the quit rate in the private sector. And that's one thing that tends to drive the market-driven supervisory ratios in the private sector. Or you could say it conversely negatively drives the ratio in the public sector. I didn't see that concept or anything that looked like that in your the factors that impact the supervisory ratio. Do you want to just talk to that? Or?
Sure. Chair Reed, Representative Nierman, I didn't bring that information today regarding the data related to, we call that in our agency, the retention rate. I think we're on the same page on what we're talking about. We haven't done a study on that to see what has been going on with managerial employees, but I think that's a really good idea, and we'll start working on that, and I'll get that back to you when we have that. We have some positions within the state government just globally that we're having trouble filling, and we are seeing some positions globally that have high turnover rates for a number of reasons. There are times that there are just better opportunities elsewhere, or they take an opportunity to move up from state government into another position, for instance, in a city or county. We see that also.
Yeah.
But I can certainly get some data back to you if you think that would be helpful.
Good. I think that would be helpful. Would you do that, please?
Be happy to do so.
I have one more question for you, and then I know there are a number of other people we want to hear from, and that is whether you could expand a little more. I assume in the bill we're talking about a plan, so I assume that what I'm about to ask would, if the bill passed, would be contained in the plan. But you mentioned about the experience you had around mission critical exceptions, I think was the term you used. What was that like? How frequent was that? How were those defined? And what was that like?
Chair Reed, I can give you a little bit of information about those because they come across my desk.
Great.
So the process that was designed in the executive branch is that those needed to be approved by the DAS director. Mm-hmm. So they come across my desk. I do review. I have some policy analysts that look into the situation. And then I actually meet with the DAS director to approve those or not. The kinds of things that we're seeing are those things that I talked to you about. Those times when we have a geographically dispersed location, and we cannot figure out a way to cover that. And we sometimes heard from employees that I don't feel safe. I need my supervisor here. I need more than what I have. Some of them are program changes. So if we have new programs and a new supervisory position is created, they need to come through my office and have those taken to the DAS director. There are two agencies, military and forestry, who have broader exceptions because their workforce ebbs and flows. And I'm sure you can imagine with military emergencies and fires and those sorts of things, they need to be a little bit more agile to flex their supervisory control at times. So those are the kinds of things we see. I don't think we see a lot of them, but we do look at them. We look at them very carefully and reach out. We want org charts and we want justifications, and it's a packet of stuff. And it is a process that we've been using, I think, for about 3 years.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Let's move on to the rest of our list. If you can stick around, I think there's a chance we may come up with more questions that you'd be suited to answer. Thank you very much. So let's hear next from Joe Chambers, Greg Monahan, and Emma Calloway, please. Three seats here for you. Decide the order in which you testify. Please begin by introducing yourself, and we'll be glad to hear your testimony.
Chair Tobias Reed, Vice Chair Joe Gallegos, and members of the committee. My name is Joe Chambers. I live in Corvallis, Oregon, and work at Oregon State University, supporting student success as an IT programmer analyst. I'm president of Sublocal 83 of SEIU 503, which represents classified staff of the OSU. I'm here today to support House Bill 3049, a bill that would set staff ratio goals of 7 frontline workers to 1 supervisory employee at the 7 universities in Oregon. As others have or will mention, with the passage of House Bill 2152 in the 2013 legislative session, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, individual university campuses, and the college community colleges are mandated to report staffing ratios. The ratio reports should represent the numbers of administrators and supervisory staff in relation to the numbers of frontline workers, faculty, and staff, and the numbers of students served. The goal of the reports is to drill down on the ratios of supervisors to workers to best serve students. The state went through a similar process with DAS agencies, as you've already heard, and state workers in 2011 and 2012, where they set a desired ratio of 1 supervisor to 11 frontline staff. All involved, including the legislature, felt it necessary to have a better idea of the current ratio in our higher education institutions before setting a standard. The first OSU released report in December of 2013 found on average that there was 2.9 classified service workers for every 1 supervisor system-wide. The second OSU report came out this fall and found that there was a slight increase of 3.1 classified service workers for every 1 supervisor. This feels unacceptable. In light of the reports and the need to streamline management to serve and bring down costs for students, it is necessary to set target ratios for universities, similar to how it was done for state service. We realize there are differences at universities and in academia, so the ratio should not mirror state policy goals. House Bill 3409 offers a ratio of 1 supervisor to 7 frontline classified staff as a first step for each of the 7 universities as the way to increase the number of frontline staff, hold in check managerial forces, and save valuable resources for student services and classroom success. I'll close my testimony with an example at our campus of what we believe is excessive supervisory oversight. Our indoor campus spaces at OSU total approximately 2 million square feet that needs custodial services, including offices, classrooms, dorms, gyms, cafeterias, and auditoriums. There's a current proposal on the table to have 23 classified staff do that cleaning services, and there would be some 10 to 12 supervisory or administrative people above those workers. We as a union are pushing back on that idea, but want you to know that this is an example of why set standards are needed. A number of other SEIU classified staff send in testimony with examples electronically that should be on the meeting materials records. We would appreciate it if you reviewed those documents as well, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chambers. Mm-hmm. Ms. Galloway?
Good morning, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Student Association, and our 45-member board discussed this policy at length. We believe that there are opportunities to cut costs within our institutions, and we think that a staffing ratio of 7-1 is perfectly reasonable. I think there are opportunities, or we may hear from opposition that there's a special place in higher ed for a large number of administrators. And the way that students feel is that as we are moving towards increased costs, we cannot treat higher education any different than we're treating a lot of other sectors. We believe we should find ways to cut costs. We believe that rising tuition is being, all of the burden is being placed on the backs of students. And there's an opportunity to have more workers that are closer to the student experience, closer to where the students are actually paying for it. And we would like to see that. We are eager to see what the design would look like. We're intrigued by the DAS presentation and wonder what it would be like to have fewer administrators on campus. At the end of the day, though, our students are most interested in ways that we can cut costs at our institutions, ways that we can run very lean operations where possible, and we want to make sure that our institutions have a uniformed process across the board, because as we move towards institutional boards, we don't want to move towards a world where every institution has different standards on cost and different mechanisms. So we'd like to see a uniform system, and we think that setting a standard from the state legislature through our elected officials is the best way to do that. So thank you very much, and we eagerly ask you to support House Bill 3049.
Thanks, Ms. Galloway. Dr. Monahan.
Chair Reed, members of the Higher Education Innovation Workforce Development Committee, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Greg Monahan, and I am the Vice President of the Association of Oregon Faculties, an organization that represents faculty members from all seven of our public universities. I'm appearing today to speak in favor of House Bill 3049, and I'd like to do that with a not too hypothetical story. Recently, the legislature broke up the university system and allowed each of the seven institutions to have their own boards. I'm not here to discuss the wisdom of that decision, but based on a lifetime spent on college campuses as both a student and a professor, I can confidently predict what will happen. Each institution will appoint a director for board relations. That director will hire an administrative assistant. Within 2 years, that director will become a vice provost for board relations. He or she will then hire an associate vice provost for board communications. That person will hire an administrative assistant. Seeing the need for better PR, the associate vice provost will hire a director of public relations and legislative affairs for the board. That person will hire an administrative assistant. Because upper-level administrators create large quantities of paper, the six management administrators will team up to hire two office specialists. That's a management to non-management ratio, by the way, of 2-1. Assuming this scenario comes to pass, the total cost of these eight positions, including the optional payroll expenses, medical benefits, travel to meetings, PERS contributions, services, and supplies, could easily top $1 million per institution. Though some of the smaller ones might make do with only three or four new management administrators, the bigger ones will probably find eight inadequate, so the total numbers may even out. Now, what will happen then? An overburdened English writing faculty member with a class of 40 students will meet with the provost, begging for help. Maybe one or two more faculty so that students get the kind of individual help they need. Academic advisors, financial aid advisors, success coaches will all plead for a little help so that they can help students plan their schedules, get the resources they need to succeed. But the provost will shake his head sadly and say, "Oh, I so wish I could help you, but we just don't have the money." Indeed, because of an unanticipated $1 million hole, he or she will say, "Sadly, I'm afraid we're going to have to make some more cuts." And when students come to see the president asking him or her not to raise tuition, I'll give you one guess as to what the answer will be. And when all this is done, how many more students will we be educated as a result of this administrative bloat? Not one single student. HB 3049 is aiming to help stop such wasteful bureaucratic bloat. It will certainly put substantial pressure on the universities to limit the number of administrators they hire. And best of all, it will not cost the state of Oregon a single penny. This is the kind of bill that both Democrats and Republicans can agree on. And how often do we get one of those? It demands that the universities spend their money more efficiently, more wisely, and largely on people who are more likely to be in the trenches actually serving students than sitting in offices generating reams of paper. Those administrators are going to appear before you, if they haven't already, and plead with you not to interfere with their very efficient efforts to serve students. When they do, I hope you will remember the story I've just told you. And I thank you for letting me appear before you today.
Thank you, Dr. Monahan. Other questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
Just curious. Thank you so much for your story. Very memorable, and it'd be amusing if it weren't so true. But are there contractual issues that will arise as we try to make these adjustments to the staffing ratios? Are there the local contracts that we have to worry about, or how does?
Well, Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, as far as the faculty contracts are concerned, I don't think so.
Okay.
But I can't answer for the SEIU contract.
Representative Reardon, I'm really not sure of the answer to that question. I don't believe that it would affect any of these contracts.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Emma, I think it was our first panel. It must have been. I think Senator Dembro made a kind of a passing reference to some of the cost drivers, and he threw out like climbing walls, you know, that sort of thing, you know, that are maybe it's an indication of some of the features that are becoming an expectation, let's just say, the universities are providing for student enjoyment and benefit and quality of life, all of that. But I wonder, have the students been invited to, or would the students be interested in having a comprehensive discussion with the universities about the real the costs, the value-added costs to some of these things? That all, they're great things. You know, you talk about, you know, full-on gyms and exercise facilities, and obviously technology has to be everywhere, and we get all that. But I'm just saying, to really look at from the campus perspective, that there is a cost attached to that climbing wall, if it is, and that somehow does end up in the cost of tuition as well. Mm-hmm. The students ever thought about engaging with the universities and just being willing to have a really comprehensive discussion about how do all these nice things that students get used to enjoying actually end up coming out of their tuition or being paid for by their tuition too?
Mm-hmm. Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. Students absolutely would be interested in having that conversation. I know that the Oregon Student Association would be happy to help facilitate that in a statewide method or on a campus individual basis. What's interesting on our college campuses, and students have to take some of the share in that, because students do vote for increased fees that will go to rec centers or student unions, as you're referencing. So we, as students, take ownership of that shared increased facilities on campus. I will also mention that students also work very, very hard to bring down the cost of those ballot measures whenever they're up on a college campus, and there often is a lot of conflict between the students, the price of those fees, the increased features, but also the interest in the institution and being as competitive as possible. So I hope that answers your question, and I'll also highlight that what I think is wonderful about this bill is that it gets to a piece of what is possibly increased administrative bloat in a way that's very invisible to students, in a way that they have a very difficult time understanding how to contribute to this conversation when they see another dean being hired. But to answer your initial question, yes, we'd be happy to have a conversation about that, and we should all be thinking about places where we can be lean.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Rudin again. Oh, I just wanted to remind people that we had a great hearing last meeting talking about adding people to the governing board, so it would be students and student representatives and grad students. And maybe that's this justification for making those additions, so perhaps.
Thanks. Other questions? I had one, Dr. Monahan particularly. I asked in the earlier panel, I asked Ms. Zeik about the mission-critical exemptions, and I talked about in the previous bill around the $10,000. I get nervous about any sort of flat number, so I appreciated your story about a not-so-hypothetical example. Can you imagine other examples that might go the other direction, where a set number might be inappropriate? Or I'm just curious, based on your long history, Do you see dangers to setting a hard number, and what your view is on how those exceptions ought to work, whether there ought to be exceptions, or what you've seen in that regard?
Well, Chair Reed, this bill, thank you for your question, sets a goal.
Yeah.
And I think it's a goal to which they can easily aspire. There's no reason you have to have management people doing many of the jobs that they do. You can have less expensive non-management people doing a lot of these jobs, and I think the universities are perfectly capable of it. I was here earlier, and I heard, I believe it was Representative Johnson, ask a question about the ratios. I know that with recent cuts, Eastern has gone to a 5.3-1 ratio. So if the small universities can do it, I think the big ones can too.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks very much. We have one more person to testify today. That's Debbie Koreski from Portland State.
Hi, good morning again. For the record, my name is Debbie Koreski. I'm from Portland State University, and I'm here to testify with the university's concerns on the current bill. So I would be remiss if I did not start out my testimony with just some few key basic facts about what's happened within the universities over the last few years. In 2007, the average tuition and fees at Portland State University was $5,237. That number this year is almost at $8,100. In 2007, the seven public universities served 71,918 full-time students. Today, that number is over 88,000 students. In 2007, the legislature appropriated $693 million to serve those students. This year, that number was $521 million. So we've had drastic changes within the seven public universities just in the recent 6 or 7 years. Most of those changes have pushed tuition to the point where it is not affordable for students, particularly at PSU. They have forced cuts in the universities. In the current co-chair's framework of $670 million for the universities, PSU will raise tuition 4.23%, and we will make $4 million worth of cuts next year in our budget. So the employees within the universities will feel those cuts, the faculty will feel those cuts, and the administration will feel those cuts, and the students most certainly will feel that tuition increase. So that's our reality. It has created much hardship for both students and employees. Our concerns about this particular bill, when the bill was introduced, the universities met with some state agency HR managers to talk about their experience in implementing the 11-1 ratio. And what we found is that the universities are significantly different than state agencies. State agencies have very strict class and comp structures for management and employees. The universities do not. The universities are also significantly different from one another. SEIU, our SEIU contract, requires our employee definitions be pretty standard across the board, across the seven universities, because that's one collective bargaining unit. But beyond that, we're really different. When we went on our tour of state agencies to talk about what had been their experience, PSU HR folks were with me along with Southern HR folks, and it was interesting to watch them. The PSU folks, we had three people. We had our HR director. We had the person that runs our iPads data that produces the reports that keep being referred to. And we had the woman that's responsible for our class and comp management team. Southern had one person. That was their HR manager, who is also their Title IX coordinator and their affirmative action coordinator. And it was interesting to watch them talk about the disparity of the resources, even between PSU and Southern, and what some of the challenges might be should we move to this. For universities with a statewide mission, some things to, for the committee to consider if you choose to move forward with this bill would be that we also have many employees throughout the state in remote locations. Portland State carries the state's mission for social work education, so you may think that we're largely centered in Portland, but we also have people located throughout the state to carry out our mission for educating the state's social workers. OSU has employees throughout the state in many different locations. So that's something to consider. I think the other thing to consider for a research university, and that would include Oregon State University, Portland State University, and University of Oregon, who do a lot of research, is that many of the faculty apply for federal grants, and the federal grants allow them to hire one or two people. So are those people, should they be classified as supervisors? Or are they still frontline employees, that faculty member that may be teaching a class and also on a research grant who's now supervising those people? Are student workers considered workers under the 7-to-1 ratio? Are they just still students? Are they now employees? Those were questions that came up. At the smaller universities, some of the things that came up were the math department may only have two or three faculty members. So should you merge the math department with the economics department with another department to get them up to the 7-to-1 ratio and put them all underneath one department chair? Or would they be allowed to stay the math department with one department chair, even though that department chair supervises only three faculty members? So those were the types of conversations and questions that we had as we sort of discussed this with our agency counterparts. I think one of the other challenging things that we talked about was the agencies, whether they were big or small, had DAS to help them implement this. And our sense from talking to people were that DAS was Ms. Zike's department had been very helpful to a lot of agencies as they sort of navigated this change. The universities would do that now on their own, so we don't have that centralized office anymore. So those are just some of our concerns, and I have appreciated all the partnership and the help of many of the people who are in support of this bill today. I think more often than not, we agree. But today, we're in a situation where we disagree. So thank you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Kresge? Representative Johnson.
Are we going to hear from anybody representing the HEC?
We don't have anyone signed up, but note that
I would just
things back there.
Your reference to DAS being able to play a role in helping agencies with assimilating or managing a new ratio and so forth, obviously that's not available for universities. This bill kind of puts that responsibility in the lap of the HEC, so I guess I would love to hear from them about their capabilities to
sure.
At some point in time.
Dana, would you care to come up and comment? Please.
While she's coming up, Chris,
I'm
still unclear. Are we talking all people that work at the university or just a subset of them?
Only classified.
I'm looking at the bill,
not faculty.
And I correct. Think that is correct.
It says
in line 13 and 14, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission shall develop a plan for public universities listed in ORS, blah, 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 to attain a ratio of at least 7-to-1 of public employees as defined in ORS 243-650 to supervisory employees as defined in ORS 243-650. plan shall be used to develop the legislatively adopted budget as defined and may provide for transition of the ratio specified in the subsection. So I don't have the references to those ORSs, but you guys are saying that's classified?
I'm guessing.
I think our understanding of the bill is that it would apply to employees represented by a collective bargaining unit, and that's also different at each university. At PSU, our faculty is represented by a collective bargaining unit, but at some universities, they are not. So I am not an HR expert, but that is my understanding from our folks at our university.
So it doesn't sound, Representative Rudin, like we have a perfectly clear answer to that, but we can pursue that as well. We have an answer. Please come forward.
Just happen to be here.
Yeah, that's good. This is giving more time for Dana to formulate her answer.
She's thinking.
My name is Len Norwitz. I work for SEIU, and the bill's intent and design and the language should be clear that it's only talking about supervisory ratios to classify staff at these seven universities.
Thank you for the clarification.
That's what I'd heard Representative Gorsuch say, and then I wasn't quite
clear. I appreciate you asking the question and clarifying. Thank you, Mr. Norwitz. Dana.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me up. I would say as we have looked at this bill and other bills that have us taking on kind of duties to assess employee categories and ratios, that this isn't, we don't currently have capacity to do that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson?
Yeah, well, I think that's important to get that on the record. Again, harking back to my, I think, statements with the initial bill we passed this morning, good concept and stuff, but again, I think some of these responsibilities fall outside of the purview of what the heck was created to be involved in, so therein lies my concern.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I said my name. Dana Richardson, the Deputy Director for Policy and Legislative Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
You do have that down to one breath now.
I know. I almost didn't make it.
Victoria, do we have fiscal impact statements on this one? I'm not finding it on all.
No, we're not in work session.
I know, but
I have not submitted this for fiscals yet.
Okay, so that would be another interesting question to consider as well, given that what we just heard from Dana about the fiscal impact. Representative Rudin.
Debbie, does that clarification on who it's, does that change your, on who's being covered under this legislation? Does that change your testimony at all, or?
No, sir. I think that we would want to work with the people who are sponsors of the bill and have a meeting with them and sit down and talk about maybe our different interpretations and make sure that we understand exactly what the intent is and how that would be implemented. And so I would hold my comments until that time.
Thank you.
Other comments? I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And as I said before, that's everyone who has testified, plus one who signed up, plus one who hadn't. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill today? Okay, that's it. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3049. And unless there's anything else to come before the committee today, we'll adjourn. See you on Monday. Thank you.